So you figure out how far away they are, which is not a trivial operation, and produce maps. In fact, if I want to picture what the galaxy's like, or what not the galaxy, but the galaxies are like, I think of a big pile of soap suds, and you just cut through it with a knife. And the galaxies, the matter that we can see, is the soap films. And in between are these voids, and it seems to, the universe seems to be built that way for reasons we don't really understand very well.
But of course, we can't yet map where life in space exists. We haven't found it yet. But
it's got to be there.
Well, it's got to be there. Everybody says that, of course. And it would be nice to be able to show exactly where. But our growing ability to chart the cosmos, I mean, that clearly has implications for the search for life.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the most important thing in the last few years has been the Kepler probe, which has, as you know, is designed to look for planets around other stars. I don't know what the number is now. It's around 1,000 planetary systems and counting. And the point is, we're discovering that solar systems like ours, where the planets go in nice, basically circular orbits, seem to be fairly rare. And we're getting, for a while, there was sort of a period of all we were finding were these what were called hot Jupiters, these great big planets very close to their stars, obviously not suitable places for the development of life. But, you know, if you want to talk about life, you talk about what's called the continuously habitable zone, the zone where you can have liquid water at the surface for long periods of time. And what I think probably one of the most interesting ideas in the last few years has been that, you know, maybe we're not going to find planets in that continuously habitable zone, but maybe we'll find planets that have moons, which are also in that zone. And the moons might be where life would develop.
Well, given that we've found literally thousands of planets, or at least candidate planets in the case of Kepler, I mean, it sounds like there's plenty of material for a second edition. Maybe it's a bit early to talk about a second edition.
Well, the one of the scary things about trying to write about science for a general audience is that the field changes so rapidly. I know I have a textbook that has to be revised every few years, and it's always frightening how much you got to change.
Yeah, but on the other hand, suppose you didn't have to change it. I mean, that wouldn't be a very interesting
field.
That'd
be awful, yeah.
Well, finally, Jim, the title of your book, Space Atlas, suggests perhaps more ambitious plans. I mean, it's Mapping the Universe and Beyond. That's the subtitle. Mm-hmm. So how do you go beyond the universe?
Well, I mentioned earlier this idea, which I'm very much an amateur of at the moment, although it may not be right, that this is just one universe of literally uncountable number of universes out there, universes that can't communicate with each other, but which, you know, our theories tell us might be there. And the reason I like that so much, Seth, is that it makes a lot of very difficult philosophical problems go away. You don't ask, you know, why are all the constants of nature just right so that life could develop? Because what you say is, well, we happen to be in the universe where that happened, but there might be lots of universes out there where it didn't happen and they don't have life.
So the multiverse solves the problem of why our universe looks so friendly, or is so friendly.
Absolutely.
Okay. But it sounds like a real challenge to anybody who wants to make an atlas of all the universes.
Well, I'll leave that to somebody else at the moment.
All right. Well, Jim Treffel, thank you so very much for talking with me.
It's a pleasure talking to you, Seth.
James Treffel is a physicist at George Mason University and is the author of Space Atlas, Mapping the Universe and Beyond.
But speaking of navigation, whether it's cosmic or not, I mean, I'm really impressed by those salmon and the turtles and the dogs and the cats and all these critters that can find their way home. But I figure it's just a selection effect, right? The animals that couldn't do that, you know, they didn't reproduce, the ones that couldn't get home. So I'm not surprised they've all developed these techniques to get somewhere that's good for them.
We're happy to have found our production team. Without them, we would be lost. Gary Niederhoff, Barbara Vance, and Rena Shake Lesko.
Also support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David and the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, and a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to Time for a Map. You can find more Big Picture Science on iTunes and through the link on our website. And while you're there, it's easy to go on to Facebook and become a fan of the program. You can leave your comments there as well.
If you're a podcast listener and prefer over-the-air radio because you'd be somehow lost without it, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, well, consider letting them know that you like the show.
I got more crystals. This one was used by Vasco da Gama to discover Portugal. And this other one was used by the guy who discovered Machu Picchu. And this one was used by the pilgrims to find the Plymouth Voyager. Oh, no, wait, that's just a rock.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Trouble on Rock Hill.
Ain't nothing like running up and down Rock Hill.
Hey, let's move this rock!
Whoa! Sassy! Johnny's stuck under that rock! Yeah, girl, go tell Mr. Gunderson to bring his truck. You'll tell him, but only after you dispel a stereotype associated with shelter pets? People think shelter pets come with lots of initial veterinary costs?
It's dusty under here.
But in reality, most shelter pets have been vaccinated, neutered, and microchipped in case they get lost?
My pants ripped.
Sassy, Johnny needs help. What Johnny really needs is more discipline and better parental supervision? You use big words, Sassy.
Still under the rock.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
I'm Dick Lanchinsky.
Randy Dunn. Reg
Nicholas. We're the Hatchet Men.
And you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
This year's Concert of Colors Music Festival will be held at the Maxim Fisher Music Center on Woodward Avenue in Detroit the weekend of July 12th and 13th. Doors open at 1 p.m. The festival will feature live music from artists such as Third Coast Kings, HK and Les Saltimbanks, the Gabriel Brass Band, October Babies, Wayne Kramer and Melvin Davis' Rock and Soul Summit, Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars, Sheila Landis featuring Rick Maddow, and Taller Than They Appear with Marger's Vaudeville Puppets, all broadcast live on WHFR from the Comerica Diversity Stage. Stop by our table, meet your favorite DJs. That's the Concert of Colors, July 12th and 13th. See you there.
Today, my new dad and I shot off a rocket in the park.
Today, my new son and I failed to shoot off a rocket.
He knew exactly what to do.
It's not working. I had no clue what I was doing.
We set up the rocket. Hit ignition. And then?
And then nothing. Sometimes I laugh when I'm frustrated.
Then out of nowhere, the rocket launched into the air.
The rocket did get into the air.
I've never seen anything fly so high.
And then crashed into a kite.
Look out! Look out!
And then the pond.
I'll never forget that day.
Even if I tried.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of kids in foster care will take you just as you are. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Ben Montgomery about his new book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk. We'll also speak with Henry Nichols, who is an expert on the Galapagos, about his book called The Galapagos. And Avital Andrews from Sierra Magazine will share some green tips for a green 4th of July. Joining us now is Ben Montgomery. He's here to talk with us about his book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, the inspiring story of the woman who saved the Appalachian Trail. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Ben, we're glad to have you on the show. And, of course, our listeners at Sierra Club Radio are very interested in the Appalachian Trail. And your book is about an interesting piece of history related to the trail. And I'm wondering if you could start just by telling us how you came to the story and how you decided to work on this book project.
I grew up hearing stories from my mother about Emma Gatewood, these fascinating tales of an old woman on a wild adventure. I remember my mom telling me about her scaring off a black bear somewhere in the Northwest and being mistaken for a hobo passing through a town somewhere along the Oregon Trail. And I was always fascinated by her story, knowing that she had she had solo hiked the AT three times, the first woman to do so, and she had also hiked the Oregon Trail. I always was struck by this kind of primary question of why did she do this? Why did she start walking at late in life, at the age of 67? So I'm a newspaper journalist, and I did a story that got a lot of attention a couple of years ago and wound up with an agent in New York who wrote to say, hey, I wonder if you have any book ideas. And a couple surfaced, and this was the one that everybody seemed to really like. So off to the races we went.
So tell us about her story. How did she start? What made her start walking at the age of 67? And what were some of the adventures that she had along the way?
Yeah, so in 1955, she told her family that she was going on a walk and didn't fill in the details. She had, at that point, she was 67. She had 11 children, 23 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. And for all intents and purposes, she disappeared. She left her hometown of Gallipolis, Ohio, in southeastern Ohio, and nobody heard from her for about 9 weeks. And when they did finally hear from her, she had dropped a postcard in the mail back home from Roanoke, Virginia. And she explained, when I said I was going on a walk, I meant I'm trying to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail. And she had hiked at that point from Mount Oglethorpe in Georgia, which at the time was the southern terminus, all the way to Roanoke, Virginia. She had quite an adventure. First of all, she was completely unprepared for a through hike. You know, today we buy top flight backpacks and the best, lightest sleeping bags and the best hiking boots. And she struck out in KED tennis shoes. She had a handmade drawstring denim sack that she slung over her shoulder. She didn't have a sleeping bag. She had an army blanket and a shower curtain to keep her dry when it was rainy. She had a tin of Band-Aids and bobby pins and some Vicks salve and some bouillon cubes to suck on for salt. No real provisions, you know, no dry-freezed fruit or anything like that. She relied primarily on her own instincts in terms of getting food on the trail. She ate wild strawberries and blueberries and nuts and sorrel salad. It's a grass that grows along the trail. And relied often on the kindness of strangers. She would approach homes when she was hungry or in need of a bed. She would approach somebody's house along the trail and just knock and introduce herself and tell folks what she was doing and kind of invite herself to dinner.
This is such a fascinating story. What prompted her to set off on a journey like this?
That's the question I explore in the book, and it's hard to say. First of all, she never drove a car, so she did a lot of walking throughout her life. If she was going to visit a friend 10 miles away, she went on foot. So walking wasn't unique for her, but she had read about the trail in 1949 in a copy of National Geographic magazine. It was a big, full-color, 9-page spread that painted the trail, which was very little known at this point. Only a handful of men had thru-hiked the trail. But she read that one of a moderate physical well-being could, quote, hayfoot strawfoot from Georgia to Maine. She read that the trail was as wide as a Mack truck and that there were sleeping facilities within a day's walk and there was plenty of food. And she started fantasizing about walking it. She didn't tell any of her children of her plan for fear they'd try to stop her. But she began to prepare quietly to save up her money and to take a small, short adventures into the woods to sleep overnight and figure out what she would need to get by. But as she started to get attention, which was about Roanoke, Virginia, boy, newspaper reporters came out of the woodwork, and everybody wanted to know what she was doing out on the trail. And she told them all, surprisingly, something different. Often she said, I'm doing it on a lark. She said, I didn't have anything better to do. She said, I wanted to see what's over the hill and then what's over the one beyond that. And what I came to uncover interviewing 4 of her surviving children and reading through her diaries and her journals was that for 30 years, she was married to an abusive, oppressive man who, on a number of occasions, beat her within an inch of her life. And when she finally got the kids grown, they had one last fight where he broke her ribs and bloodied her nose and blacked her eyes, and she wound up in jail. He convinced the justice of the peace to arrest her because she was crazy. The mayor of this small town where they lived in West Virginia, he realized that she was a battered spouse and bailed her out. And she filed for divorce. And for the first time in her life, she didn't have to do what her husband wanted her to do. And she found this level of independence that she made the most of.
Wow, that's an incredible story. I'm curious if you can tell us more about the effect that this had on the trail and on the history of the trail. You know, what kind of impact did her story have on other people and on the development of this landmark that's become so important in American history?
It was never the idea of the fathers of the AT, the planners, the folks who started bringing it together in the 20s and 30s. It was never their idea that this would be something someone would walk in one continuous stretch. In fact, there's evidence to suggest they thought that would be impossible to, you know, to go on foot from Georgia to Maine. So it was relatively little known until around 1948, when a man named Earl Schaefer, who was walking off his demons from World War II, struck out and hiked the trail in one season, and sent a letter to the Appalachian Trail Conservancy saying, you know, I've done basically the first through hike. And they doubted him at first until he showed them pictures and showed them his journal entries. And so anyways, Earl got a little attention, but not a whole lot, a couple of newspaper stories. The second person to through hike, same thing. It was sort of overlooked. He got a story in his hometown newspaper in Macon, Georgia, and outside of that, there's not much. So when Grandma Gatewood, I think just because she was who she was, 67-year-old woman, when she started on the trail, when she hit Roanoke, Virginia, and that first newspaper story ran, I think it just captured the attention of a nation who was looking for a little distraction and a good news story and the throes of the Cold War and in the wake of some racial violence in the South after Brown versus Board of Education the year before. And so every town she walked through just about north of Roanoke, she'd run into a newspaper reporter who was there wanting to share her story. And by the end of her first journey in 55, her travels were being documented daily by the Associated Press and by the United Press. And there was a feature story on her in Sports Illustrated, several thousand words. Later on, she appeared on the You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx. She was on the Dave Garraway Show, on the Today Show. She did a ton of radio and was in newspapers across the country. And I think the American public, they were rooting for her, you know, that this woman has struck out and is doing this. It really is like an incredible physical feat at her age. And so, she was something of a hero, almost the last sort of celebrity pedestrian, if you will.
How is she memorialized today?
She has one of the most beautiful stretches of trails I've ever seen in Hocking Hills State Park in Ohio, her home state, is named after her, the Grandma Gatewood Trail. And it is just a beautiful, beautiful place. She thought it was the most interesting geology she'd ever seen. It's in a sort of a long canyon with a bunch of caves and caverns and waterfalls. So that trail is named after her. There's, she was inducted. She was a lifetime member of the National Campers and Hikers Association. She is in the Appalachian Trail Hall of Fame. She was one of five in the second class of hikers to be inducted into the AT Hall of Fame in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. And outside of that, I think, you know, she is motivation for even modern through hikers. I climbed Mount Katahdin in September of 2012 to try to sort of retrace her steps up the mountain on that inaugural through hike. And we just reached Baxter's Peak at the same time about 30 hikers were finishing through hikes. And I let them enjoy the moment a little bit and then sheepishly approached them. And I wanted to ask, you know, if they knew of Grandma Gatewood's story, and if they did, what, you know, what did they think of it? And by and large, everybody in that group knew of Grandma Gatewood at the very least, and many of them had, you know, their own experiences where she had served as motivation when times got tough. So I think she, you know, that's probably her legacy, that she fuels modern hikers in many ways. If Grandma Gatewood could do it, I can do it.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Ben Montgomery talking about his new book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk. And for more information about the book, you can visit chicagoreviewpress.com. Henry Nichols joins us today to talk with us about his book, The Galapagos. A science writer and the editor of Galapagos Matters, the biannual magazine of the Galapagos Conservancy, Henry Nichols is well-versed in both the history of the area and the most recent debates surrounding its conservation. He's here to talk with us about it today. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm curious to hear about how you first got interested in this part of the world. What drew you to the Galapagos region?
I studied evolutionary biology. And then when you do that, and Darwin is this kind of key figure, the Galapagos feels like a place you've got to go to. So that was what led me there. But that was about 10 years ago I first went.
And what were your experiences like visiting the islands? I mean, what really drew you to make this a big part of your life's work?
So I went there on holiday that first time, and I met the very famous giant tortoise, Lonesome George, as everybody who visits does, or did, I should say, because he sadly died two years ago. And he sort of struck me as this amazing subject for a book, and he was the subject of my first book. So I used him, his story, his tragic story. He was the last individual of his kind, and he was in that very rare situation for 40 years, so for the whole of my lifetime. And so I told his story and explored extinction and conservation, and the Galapagos was a big part of that. But here I wanted to actually get to know the archipelago better. So the islands themselves are the kind of subject of this almost biographical account.
Tell us about your perspective on why the Galapagos matters to all of us, no matter where we live. I mean, for folks who haven't been there, might never be there, why is it a place that you think people should care about?
Yes, there are lots of reasons, and it's sort of a nested argument, really. It obviously matters to the people that live there, and that in itself is enough reason alone. But there are 30,000 people that live there, and not everybody appreciates that. And even beyond them, it's of tremendous importance to Ecuador, which owns the Galapagos. So it's a very significant economic draw, a touristic draw, and so there's a huge amount of revenue that Ecuador generates at the national level. So for Ecuador, it quite clearly matters, not just for its economic value, of course, for its global significance, but that really is why it matters to everybody else, because everybody wants to go to the Galapagos, and it's for that iconic, really relatively untouched reason. It stands out now because we've trashed so much of the world of the Galapagos, as damaged as it might be, and it is a bit, is still remarkably special. And anyone that has visited there will recognize that. You just go there and you are suddenly in a very, very different place with respect to the other animals and plants with which we share the planet. So the intimacy you can have with nature in the Galapagos is quite an unsettling, not in a bad way, but very destabilizing. Just really gives you a radically different perspective on the world and your position in it. And so it's very, very remarkable for that.
What are some of the unusual plants and wildlife that people would see if they went to travel there?
Yes, it is. That is the kind of reason people go, but it's strange because there's actually not that much there. What is there, though, is very odd and unique. So about almost half of all species there are unique to the Galapagos. They were made in Galapagos. And so it is this site of the origin of species. It's where stuff gets created. And, of course, the giant tortoises are the most famous, and the animals that gave the islands their name. The Galapagos translates as the tortoises, or Ilas de las Galapagos. The Galapagos is the islands of the tortoises. And so they're incredibly striking, these huge, almost antediluvian creatures lumbering across this volcanic landscape. More startling, perhaps, at least to me, are these marine iguanas that lie along the shores of all these islands. And they're not very large, they're maybe 1 or 2 foot long or up to 10 kilograms in the most extreme cases. But they are extraordinary because this is the only lizard iguana that goes foraging into the sea. It goes diving down. So this is a species that rocked up there, we think, you know, as the islands were forming, and then had to survive. And there's very little vegetation, and the sort of succulent vegetation on which these iguanas would have to depend just wasn't there. So they started eating algae, and so they go down diving for this. And they have various amazing adaptations to be able to do that, amongst the most obvious one, being able to swim and dive and hold your breath and stay underwater and survive for up to an hour if they need to. They don't usually do that. So those are the most striking things. But then, of course, very, very famous are the finches, which are this, have become this kind of paradigm of evolutionary biology. So we have 14 different species of finch there. They're not very striking to look at. They're a little bit dull, but they are very important as tools, really, for teaching evolutionary biology. But these beaks differ very markedly between the different species. And we can, and have, and scientists have been doing this, monitor within the space of weeks, months, if you get a large amount of death within a population, as happens regularly, the average beak size of a species will shift measurably. I mean, if humans can measure it over the space of 1 or 2 weeks, we're talking a millimeter shift in the size of a beak. And so we can see evolution happening in this group, so it's very remarkable for that. And then there's a whole bunch of other wonderful things, notably the blue-footed boobies and several other two other species of booby, and lots of other great seabirds that you'll see there.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the ethical considerations for people who are considering traveling to the Galapagos. What are some of your thoughts on that? How can we have people explore the area without also destroying it?
I think the most important thing is to really think about just that question before you go. And that means reading, not necessarily my book, but it's not a bad starting place, but there's lots of things to read up. And really take that decision responsibly. I mean, it's a big decision to fly anywhere at all these days, and that's a major one. If you can square that, and you might be able to, then visiting the islands, there are lots of different ways in which to visit the islands, and the main distinction, I think, is whether you do a land-based, hotel-based tour, and you can just go to the Galapagos and stay in a hotel the whole time, or you get on a boat, which is much more expensive. So you could go and see the Galapagos. My feeling is that if you went on a hotel-based tour, you wouldn't see what is so special about the Galapagos, and that is the different islands and the subtle but very, very important differences between the islands. So the sorts of things that Charles Darwin came to appreciate after his 5-week visit there. I think that's really important, because it is in that we see or start to appreciate how novelty is created and new species arise. And it is that that the Galapagos is really most special for. So there's lots to think about, and I think people need to shop around and ask around and ask where their money, it's a lot of money to go, where their money is going to go and how it is going to do the most good. And I think if you've thought through some of those things, then you're in a good place, really. But largely, the tours are incredibly wonderfully run, and the natural history guides are amazingly highly qualified. I would say that choosing a highly qualified guide is very important. They come at three different levels, so you could really get a very different quality of experience depending on the level of guide you choose. And it is very much worth paying more to get the top quality guide. You will just have a completely different experience.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Henry Nichols, author of a new book, The Galapagos. Joining us now in our studio is Avi Taub, the Green Living editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Orly.
So today we're going to talk about how to green your 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
How can you do a green, let's start with barbecue. How do you do a green barbecue?
There are a few things you can do. One is consider your coal. And anyone affiliated with the Sierra Club knows how we feel about coal. So what you can do, if you're looking for a grill, if you don't already have one, you can choose an electric or a propane-powered grill or a solar oven over a cooker that burns through charcoal. And granted, those aren't amazing either, but they are cleaner burning.
Okay, so that is one better option.
Yeah, those are a couple.
If you're going to use briquettes, are there kinds that you can use that have less of an impact?
There is, yes. Yeah. So if you've only got a coal-fired grill and you don't want to trash it quite yet to replace it with a cleaner one, you can choose briquettes that are made of things like invasive tree species or from sustainably managed forests. And if that sounds kind of opaque and you're not sure how to find those, if you're looking for the FSC logo or the Rainforest Alliance logo, you'll do well when you're choosing your coal or your charcoal.
Great. So if people have their grill all set up, and hopefully they're choosing one of these greener options, the next choice is food. So what do you consider green food choices for a barbecue?
Considering that UN report that came out that says that raising livestock for food creates more pollution than all modes of transportation combined, this is definitely something to take into account. And that fact would naturally lead you toward vegetarian recipes. And there are really some great vegetarian grilling recipes. People kind of shy away from them because it's the 4th of July. But if you just Google vegetarian grilling recipes, you will find thousands. And a lot of them are really hearty and satisfying.
And, you know, we've done a couple really great interviews over the years with different cooks and chefs on this topic. And I know that there are people out there who say, you know, it's the 4th of July, I need to have some meat. I mean, that to them is really part of the holiday. But when we had Mark Bittman on the show a while ago, one of the things he pointed out as a chef is that, you know, you can still cut back on meat usage even if you don't want to be a vegetarian. Reducing the amount of meat that you eat is also a way that you can contribute.
Absolutely. And yeah, we definitely don't want to be extremist about this when we talk to people about eating less meat. That doesn't mean you have to be a complete vegetarian. You can just eat maybe, you know, half a hot dog or and then just supplement those calories with salad or corn or something else. But if you're eating, you can still have your token meat item and still have that 4th of July feeling. But yes, eat less meat.
Well, of course, it's very similar to driving a car. I mean, the best thing to do is to give up your car entirely and ride a bike. But for people who can't do that,
exactly,
cutting back on the car usage.
Exactly. If we're looking at realistic options for some people.
Now, let's talk about things like cutlery and flatware.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the times when people go to the 4th of July barbecue, if you're trying to be green, you feel guilty about throwing out all the disposable stuff. So what do you do about that?
So, yeah, this is going to depend on your situation, whether you're out at a public park having a picnic or doing something in your backyard. If it's at home, you really don't need to go out and get those disposable plastic things unless you're going to wash them and reuse them. But it's just, you know, it's always best to use your reusable stuff that you've got at home. But if you've got to go throw away, then get the biodegradable stuff, get something that can be recycled or composted. And the same goes with napkins. You know, if you've got cloth napkins at home, bring them along and just throw them in the laundry after instead of throwing them away after. If you've got paper napkins, put them in the compost. Just sort of be smart about your situation and what you've got to do.
Well, those are some great 4th of July tips for greening your barbecue event. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Avital, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
The grizzly bear is an iconic symbol of the American West. As many as 50,000 once roamed the western half of the United States, south of Canada. Today, their numbers have dwindled to about 1,600, isolated in the northern Rocky Mountains. For grizzlies to survive, they must be able to travel safely between large blocks of habitat. But the crucial pathways connecting these areas are being lost to development. The Vital Ground Foundation is working to ensure the future of the majestic grizzly by conserving strategically located wildlife habitat. By protecting land in exactly the right places, Vital Ground doesn't need to save thousands of acres, just the hundreds of acres that provide the greatest impact. To find out how you can help, visit www.vitalground.org, where the grizzly can walk, the earth is healthy and whole.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Kotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Paul Loeb about the new edition of his book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While. We'll also hear from the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign director, Marianne Hitt, about historic new protections from carbon pollution that the EPA has issued this week. And finally, we'll get some green living tips from Avital Andrews at Sierra Magazine. Joining us now is Paul Loeb to talk with us about the new edition of his book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While. Welcome.
Hey, very glad to be here.
So, you know, Paul, we had you on our show a while back when the first edition of this book came out, and the first edition was published during the years of the Bush administration, so I'm wondering if we could start by talking a little bit about what was different for you in revising a book in the current political atmosphere and what you were hoping to accomplish with a new edition.
Yeah, it's interesting because that was a period that certainly a lot of like environmental activists were feeling fairly bleak, and yet at the same time, I think there was this hope that that administration would pass and then things would get better, and whatever one thinks about Obama, I think there was a kind of hope that was vested in him. I mean, in some sense, the campaign was branded around hope. And then when it didn't instantly bring the millennium, and you know, one can argue the particulars of he was been good on this and he's not been good on this other area, but it's left people, I think, a little bit more demoralized. That plus just the unfortunate march of time in areas like climate change where, it's now a decade later, and the things that we're doing now, if we'd done them then, it would have been amazing, but now we're sort of playing catch up. And so I think there's a tendency, and this is why in some ways I reissued because The Impossible Will Take a Little While was always in print, but came up with a sort of comprehensive new edition, was just addressing the demoralization of, I felt that a lot of activists would tell me, and they would just say, I've been working so long, and it's not the traction we'd hope we have hasn't arrived. And so trying to give a context to say, well, sometimes these things take time. And of course, when you're dealing with something like climate change, the question of time is tricky because in a social justice context, you can say, we worked on this, one generation passed the torch to another, eventually we got the progress we needed. We don't have those multiple generations, obviously, on something like climate change, but the persistence and the need to continue, it may be you're sitting there, you're trying to work on a project, and there's a referendum coming up, and it's just, okay, here it is. You've got to keep on, and you've got to keep on, or you do a project, it doesn't quite go where you want. Do you jump back in again, or do you get ground down? So to me, the need of perseverance is essential, whether or not we're talking about generations of time frames to act, or whether we're talking about something with a much more acute time frame. And either way, I think it still comes into play.
What are some of your favorite pieces and stories from the book and anything new in the new edition that people should look out for?
Well, I love the Mary Pitzer piece about, I think you've had her on the show directly, but what's interesting to me is I've known her as a friend for, I think almost 30 years now. And she's always been an amazing writer, but her instincts aren't to be the political organizer. And yet what I love is that here the Keystone Pipeline was coming across not that far from where she lives in Nebraska and had a response, like many people do, of, gee, can we really do anything? It's already bought and sold. They've dumped more money than Nebraska has ever seen, taking this very radical act of holding a potluck with a few friends. And then that grows into the nationwide resistance to Keystone. And so to me, it's such a quintessential example of how you don't really know where something's going to lead. And sometimes you jump into the void and you say, well, I've got to do this because it's the right thing to do, even though I'm not really quite clear what the path is to prevail. And then that path opens up. And it's just, so I look at that. There's some wonderful material on the Arab Spring. And we can sort of say, oh, well, they lost. And, gee, you know, look at what has had the mess that's happened in Egypt. But I remember talking with a young woman who was involved in the overthrow of Mubarak in Egypt. And she said, this is about what we've learned. This is about the power that we've gained. And we're not going to, whole generation has learned it. We're not going to unlearn it. And one of the lessons, I think, from the impossible will take a little while, is that movements and ideas and approaches that are transferable between historical times and between different issues and different contexts. So you really can take something that happens in Cairo, Egypt, and apply it to climate change or to pure water issues or the collapse of the bee colonies or whatever it happens to be. I mean, the specifics are going to differ, but the way that people can draw inspiration from each other's actions. Nelson Mandela uses the phrase, the multiplication of courage, which is something that a phrase I really admire. That's something that it extends beyond particular issues. So somebody working, on environmental issues, the profound lessons to learn from the civil rights movement. There's profound lessons to learn from the people overthrowing the dictatorships in Eastern Europe. And so, to me, one of the advantages of pulling together these kind of global voices, as I do in The Impossible Will Take a Little While, is that it allows people to learn from very radically different movements.
In your opinion, I mean, how can we find hope on climate change and tough environmental issues that just seem to be getting tougher? And what can we really draw on to keep going in a motivated way?
Well, I think in some ways it's a couple of the writers. There's a wonderful piece by David Roberts of Grist magazine. Mark Hertzgaard talks a lot about it in his piece. There's a friend, Casey Golden, who does a thing called Climate Solutions out of Washington State, where I live. And in some ways, they're all talking about the difference between feeling like something's inevitable and something is possible. So if something is inevitable, if we just say the march of climate change is inevitable, there's nothing we can do, well then, at some level it doesn't really make sense to do anything about it. But if we actually say you do not know what's going to occur, and this is, again, something that we learn from other movements as well, I guess 32 years ago I was kicked out of Stanford University for anti-Vietnam War protest. And I looked at the headlines just recently, and Stanford divests from coal. Now, I would not, as a betting person, I would not have bet on that huge entrenched power, institution of power, to take that leap. And yet it did, and that's going to set all sorts of other ripples. How did it happen? Well, it happened because, as it always does, because there were students there pushing. In this case, there obviously were some administrators who were receptive and thought it through and said, yeah, let's take a moral stand. And something very important happened. But would it have been something that we would have expected? I don't think so. And so, you draw hope from that. You draw hope from the concrete possibilities. Hertzgaard's piece, he talks a lot about just the stunning rise of renewables in the last few years. And I think the phrase that some of the analysts use is that it's the adoption rates are faster than cell phone adoption rates. And so we don't know where that curve is going to be headed. I mean, if you look at it, it's flat. It's sort of gentle, and then suddenly it starts really taking off. And so at any point, to me, you, instead of sort of saying, okay, here are the foreclosed possibilities, we say, this is what we actually can do. Now how do we make it happen? And that's, I think, the challenge on climate change is to sort of, I mean, to keep talking about, yeah, these are seriously ultimate stakes, and the only comparable analog to me is the nuclear arms race, but that had simpler solutions. This has more multiple solutions, and so it's going to take at every point where institutions are acting as they're shifting their behavior. I think people can say, and it's not about looking small, it's about looking at these institutions saying, all right, what can you do to take the lead? What can you do to emulate, have one institution emulate another? I mean, the project that I work on most is a project to get students involved in the elections. And we're always encouraging schools to look at each other and say, this is what one institution did. You can do this too. And so it's inspiration and shaming maybe coupled with each other and a lot of grassroots organizing. And so even though, you know, on some level, you know, every week brings a new report of Antarctic sea ice or sea level rises or whatever it happens to be, at the same time, when I look at people achieving something that seems highly improbable, that gives hope because you don't know what new possibilities emerge from it. And so it's Howard Zinn, who died a few years ago, has a wonderful essay in the book, and it's the optimism of uncertainty. But the uncertainty isn't a you wait and you see what will happen kind of uncertainty or kind of hope. It's a you act and you open up possibilities. Jim Wallace of Sojourners has a wonderful piece and talks about believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change by our actions. And I think that, to me, I mean, he was speaking from a particularly religious perspective, but religious or secular, that to me is what's essential, is recognizing that if you're in a situation that seems wholly impossible, you know, you're in Robben Island prison in South Africa and you're told you're never going to leave alive, that even in that context there's ways to act that end up changing history. And that certainly in our context there are ways as well. And we may, as in the Mary Pike, for example, we may only discover those ways when we begin to act on them.
With all of the challenges that we face in the world today, do you have any thoughts on how we can approach social change with joy? I mean, how can we help people approach activism not just with a sense of obligation, but with really a true sense of opportunity?
Yeah, I think that's really critical. And I remember I was speaking at a school, I guess it was in Rochester, New York, and the person, one of the students' favorite musicians is Ani DeFranco, and he didn't want to go here in Buffalo because he was going to have to drive. And I said, look, you know, there isn't any public transit, you know, to get you to Buffalo, carpool, but go, this will sustain you. And I think that there's a way that we can get locked into our own bleakness and grimness. And I open The Impossible Take a Little While with a story of Desmond Tutu at a benefit of this for South African Project, and joking and laughing and teasing and dancing when this music starts happening. And this is somebody who certainly witnessed more of the blindness and callousness of humanity than anyone I can think of. He's always diving into the hard situations, and yet he comes out of it driven by this joy of living, and then that makes his message infectious. And so I think this is a real issue for all of us, because if we do, you know, we're willing to look past that denial, we're willing to say, okay, this is this future, and look at it squarely. And that's not always easy to do, but if our response is to sort of let our panic overwhelm us, we're not going to be effective. I remember years ago during the anti-nuclear movement, nuclear weapons movement, nobody did more than Dr. Helen Caldicott to galvanize that movement. And yet at a certain point, she started getting growing apocalyptic and brittle. And I mean, it was a movement that was dealing with apocalypse, but she would start driving people back in their shells. And I remember she said, there's a mathematical certainty of nuclear war if Ronald Reagan is reelected. And Ronald Reagan got reelected, and, you know, suddenly, where does that leave people? So I think you, in the whole approach that we take, even as we have to be absolutely clear about the stakes. And the stakes are ultimate. You've got to do it with joy. You've got to savor the time of the people together. And then go back to Mary Pipefer and the potluck. They said it was really important to have some good food there because then they could enjoy each other's company, even if they didn't figure out every solution instantly. And I've always found that to be true. The more you end up with this kind of fertile community, the more powerful your message is. And so I think that joy has to be part of it. And that there's a lot of poetry in Impossible Will Take a Little While because those poems somehow, they aren't all, they lift your spirits. They are, you know, they aren't all sort of naive, oh, everything's beautiful and wonderful, but they lift our spirits. I mean, there's one just classic Wendell Berry poem about, you know, going and hearing these creatures, the woodlock, sing, and when he's feeling dark, and it washes his soul. So I think, you know, I think that's part of it. I mean, remembering to get sustenance from the world that we're trying to save.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. We've been listening to Paul Loeb, and he was talking with us about his new edition of his book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While. And for more information, you can visit the website at theimpossible.org. Joining us now is the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, Marianne Hitt. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Marianne, we've had you on our show a number of times recently to talk about some of these different new protections that EPA is coming out with to protect the American public. And one of the newest ones that we're really excited about are these new protections from carbon pollution. And that was just announced earlier this week. And I wanted to start just by having you tell us a little bit about, you know, what does it mean that we're seeing these historic new protections from carbon pollution? What does that mean in terms of people around the country who are concerned about climate change?
Well, these first ever carbon standards for power plants are indeed very exciting and a very big deal because it really marks the first time our country has taken a serious run at grappling with our single biggest source of the carbon pollution that's threatening our climate, and that is coal-fired power plants. Many Americans, we actually did a poll at the Sierra Club, a majority of Americans think that there are already federal standards in place for carbon pollution from power plants, given what a real threat climate change poses to our country and to our future and to our economy. But in fact, there are no such regulations in place. Coal plants can put 100% of their carbon pollution up into the air with no limits whatsoever. So the Obama administration has taken a very important step in putting out these draft carbon pollution standards for power plants, and now it's up to the American people to get involved and to show their support for strong leadership.
Now, this has been a cornerstone of the president's climate action plan that he announced at Georgetown University last year. Isn't that correct?
Indeed. In June of 2013, the president gave a very historic speech about climate change at Georgetown University, where he outlined a number of measures he was going to take using his authority as our commander-in-chief and our president to tackle climate change. And it really ran the gamut of, you know, everything from energy use and transportation, electricity, energy efficiency, but the real crown jewel of the whole plan and the centerpiece were these carbon standards for power plants. And since then, they have been working to get input from states, to get input from regular people. We have had over 4 million comments submitted in support of this general, tackling of carbon pollution from power plants, 4 million supportive comments from the American public. They had 11 listening sessions after the announcement to solicit input from people. So it's been a very big effort by the White House. The president personally is putting a lot of his energy into these standards. And again, now we have the draft in front of us, so now we have to do the hard work of demonstrating that the American people want to get this over the finish line and they want the standards to be strong and meaningful.
So not to get too deep into process here, but explain to our listeners a little bit about how this works, because you're saying that these are draft standards. And then, you know, what is the next step before the final standards would go into place and actually, we would have the protections enacted?
The EPA has been very clear about the timeline. The draft standard that was just issued is going to now be the subject of a comment period, so people can submit their comments online or in writing. They can attend public hearings. We will soon be we'll know where those are. People can get in touch with the Sierra Club to learn more. Then the comment period will close, and EPA will take all those comments and take them under consideration and come back in the summer of 2015 with a final rule. And once that rule is in place, the way this particular regulation is going to be implemented is by the state. So every state is going to have to come up with a plan of how it is going to implement these carbon standards. And again, that is going to be a process where people being involved is going to make all the difference. So starting now and through the end of President Obama's term and even beyond, public involvement in this is going to be the key to getting strong results for our climate and for our clean air and water.
And before we wrap up, why are you most excited about this? I mean, you're someone who's worked in the, you know, the advocacy world for a long time. You've been working on environmental issues your whole career. You know, what is it about this new announcement this week that gives you hope?
Well, anyone who has been following the news about climate change, whether it's the big ice sheets breaking off recently, whether it's the National Climate Assessment that showed how we're already feeling the effects of climate change with worse fires and storms and droughts, and how the forecast for the future could be very grim if we stay on the current course. For all of those reasons, seeing this action from the president and seeing our White House and our, you know, leader of our nation take on the biggest source of climate pollution is hugely exciting and encouraging, and I think definitely merits the support and involvement of people all around the country, because really we have a small window of time, you know, 10 or 15 years, when every single action we take on climate change could be a game changer. And I am confident that we as a country are going to provide the leadership that the rest of the world needs, and this is really an important piece of that puzzle. And so this is a very important moment for the environmental movement, for all the supporters of the Sierra Club out there, and we really need folks involved.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Marianne Hitt, the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Hi, really good to be here.
It's great to have you back. Today we're going to talk about this piece that you have in the May-June issue of Sierra Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You've gotten a reputation at Sierra Magazine for always doing these different pieces where you compare different eco foods. I know you did one on different eco ice creams and mm-hmm. one on different granolas, right?
Beer, fast
trail
food,
mix,
all the fun stuff.
Yeah. So now we're looking at this issue of the magazine with a piece called Schmear Campaign, talking about different eco or green, different spreads and dips that
mm-hmm.
you can have.
Yeah. Yeah, this was sort of a tough one for me to define because, you know, when you say dips, that doesn't come to mind immediately. But my first thought was nut butters, because that's a really popular category. And then I sort of expanded because hummus is a huge category now. So I just figured dips and spreads that you can put on crackers and breads, if you can sort of imagine that. We've got a great photo spread that illustrates it in the magazine. But
so what were some of the best tasting things that you picked, and why were they green?
Yeah, so there's a really great, so like I said, I started with the idea of looking into peanut butters or nut butters. I had learned that more than 800 peanuts go into one 18 ounce jar of peanut butter. So if you, that's like so many peanuts, which, you know, if they're not organic and if it's done wastefully, it's not good. So the amount of peanut butter and nut butters that we Americans consume is a lot. So I wanted to find one that is eco-friendly. And one brand really jumped out. The brand's called Justin's. You might have heard of it. It's sold in Target. It's a really big brand, actually. And their best tasting product is called honey almond butter. And it's really smooth and sweet, and it goes perfectly on everything from rice cake to banana. It's high protein, which is good for us vegetarians. It's GMO-free, meaning it has no genetically modified ingredients. It comes in a jar that's recycled plastic and, of course, recyclable as well. The only ingredients in it are California-grown almonds, sugar, honey, sea salt, and palm oil. And palm oil usually should raise a red flag if you hear that or see that on a jar, but this particular palm oil was sourced from a sustainable farm as opposed to a clear-cut forest in Indonesia, which palm oil often is. And Justin's the brand generally uses organic ingredients. So Justin's in general, and then their honey almond butter in particular.
Let's talk about in the hummus category.
Yeah.
That's great for snacking. Yeah. What did you find that was unusual, tasty, and also eco?
Yeah. So there's a brand called Eat Well, Enjoy Life, which I love that name. It's sort of a long name, but, you know, makes me happy. And their best product that I could determine was the sweet and spicy black bean hummus. It comes with corn, pineapple, red peppers, pecans, chipotle chilies, and this medley of spices. It's really good, especially if you like black beans.
And what made it green or eco?
So this is also GMO-free, no genetically modified ingredients. The packaging is not recycled, unfortunately, but it's made of a highly recyclable plastic. I don't generally like to promote recyclable because a lot of stuff's recyclable, but it is. It's highly recyclable. And one really fun thing is it's a paperless company. So Eat Well, Enjoy Life recycles all their waste and is completely paperless. So it's just a green company.
Well, we have time for one more. I was interested in the sesame butter that you reviewed. What does that taste like, and what should our listeners know about it?
Yeah, this is a really interesting product. It's called Premium Organic Sesame Butter. It's from a company called Golden Millstone. And it's made from just one ingredient. They're sesame seeds harvested from small organic farms in Ethiopia with workers who are treated in a fair trade way. And the sesame seeds are slow roasted at temperatures that are low enough to keep this a raw food. And then they're ground on a 90-year-old millstone, hence the brand name. And it just tastes really nutty. If you've had tahini, basically, that's what tahini is, and it's just this really delicious, nutty-tasting, nutrient-dense butter that, you know, you can put really on anything. And it comes in a glass jar, so obviously that's BPA-free, recyclable, and they're all the benefits of glass.
Well, I should also add before we wrap up that one of the fun things about this piece is that you add a way for people to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, the greenest thing of all is to make things at home and not have to buy something with packaging.
So
They have a great recipe here for carrot cashew miso spread from a James Beard nominated chef.
Yeah. She was kind enough to let us reprint a version of her recipe. And it's amazing. It's if you see the picture in the magazine, it's this bright orange and the flavor is just as lively. It's this really great recipe, and we are trying to include DIY recipes in all of our food pieces because it really is the greenest way to go. It's local. You don't have to deal with packaging. You can store it in your freezer and as much as you can make food yourself, you can do it.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine.
Thanks, Orly.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through